Welcome to Shortcut to Sunday. I'm Ben.
I'm Bruce.
And this is your podcast for, what day is, or is our podcast for? October 15th, 2023.
Sunday,
yes. For this coming Sunday. No further information required. It's the 20th Sunday after Pentecost, and we are still in year A. But we are coming to you not live on behalf of Holy Family Episcopal Church in Fishers, Indiana. Bruce, are you feeling rambunctious today?
Well, I've been playing with all sorts of little kids around the church.
Yeah, our inner children have been
drawn
engaged
out.
And drawn out. That's a good way to put it.
So I have a feeling I'm almost out of rambunctious.
Right. Yeah, we're about to do a nosedive on energy and just fall asleep mid podcast. So
no, I'm not that bad yet.
Just wait to the 27 minute mark, and we'll be out.
You'll hear a gentle snoring.
It's because my questions are boring.
Well, when you hear the snoring, it is a time to center oneself.
Ooh.
And so just ponder whatever scripture we were just talking about.
Right.
And it'll probably be better than what you normally hear.
You know, chances are.
Yeah.
Yeah, you might not be wrong. We are, as far as like what's going on in the church, we have, I think it's relative, like, I don't think we have anything specific coming up this week
right.
That needs promoting. We have our same educational offerings that we've been pointing to, our next event of note, I think, is the Trunk or Treat event.
Correct.
Okay. And of course, that's Thanksgiving. No, that's for Halloween.
Wouldn't that be delicious?
It would. It would.
Yeah.
Okay. So, that'll be, is that on Sunday?
No.
It is on which day? No. Is it actually Halloween or?
No. Try again. I'm pretty sure the 27th.
The 27th.
Friday, okay. The 27th.
So, gotcha. It's that Friday. So, mark it on the calendars. It's not yet. Don't worry. You have time.
Yeah.
Although the cost of candy is becoming more exorbitant the longer you wait, and it goes up a little bit actually.
Does it?
As you get closer.
I thought it would go on sale.
It goes on sale the day after.
Oh, okay.
Our
first year living in the house we're in, I was at Meijer's at like 7 p.m. buying more candy because we totally underestimated.
Right, right, right. And they're like, oh, I see you want this bag of candy. $30.
Right.
You don't want to disappoint them kids,
hey,
do
you? Mr. Scrooge.
Right, exactly. Still plenty of time to find it. As you're listening to this podcast, it is in abundance. If you put it on off until like the following week, you might start to get like, oh yeah, the Snickers packs are gone. But there is, you know, this janky brand of whatever.
You know,
there's always plenty of candy corn though.
What's interesting to me is it seems like Dum Dum suckers have come back. Those used to be the
exactly.
But now it's like, hey,
I don't know what it is.
Dum-dum.
I don't know what it is. There was a little bit of a sucker revitalization when I was in, when would that have been? Late high school. There was like this new the different flavor suckers, and they were like deemed to be exotic, but it was like it's pineapple banana, like okay.
Yeah.
Like I get it, it's fancier,
right?
But like but they were like selling for like $4 or $5, and it was like they were larger, they weren't the dum-dum size. But there was like this whole revitalization of the sucker industry.
Yeah.
There for a little bit, and then it died again, and then it seems to be kind of the traditional, the originals are coming back.
Yeah.
In force, and my kids love them.
Yeah, our grandkids do.
I want a Dum Dum. Luckily for you, you get to talk to one right now. not a bunch of things to point out, but certainly still plenty of things going on.
Yeah.
At the church. As far as special events, that's our next one to point
mm-hmm.
to. If you ever want to do a special event, one thing I have never done on this podcast, and I really should promote the fact that, hey, we can help you put something on if you want to do something. We literally, I went around the building today with a person way more knowledgeable than me about electronics. And for whatever reason, the thing that I thought was broken is now not broken. And he stood close enough to fix it. And we now have fully functioning sound and video offerings in the parish hall that could reasonably accommodate pretty much any kind of event that you want to do. Yeah. So if you have an idea,
I think it seats 200 people.
Yeah. I'm not sure if the fire marshal will be.
That was with the fire marshal.
The parish hall?
Yeah.
We don't have 200 chairs. Don't.
I was going to say, we have to get them out of the attic, the plastic ones.
There you go.
But yeah.
But reasonably, like, yeah, if you have an idea as to like something that would be fun to put on and you have the means or the wherewithal to gather together a crew that could accomplish it, hey, let us know. We're game. Happy to
try anything once.
Careful.
Okay, no neo-Nazis.
Within reason. An event that would reasonably be hosted at a church location, we would be willing to.
Yeah, in light of the news this week, no monkeys.
Yeah, right. Yes.
There was an escaped monkey that was like on the front page of the Indianapolis Star. Although, you
know what? Again, I'd try anything once. That's not wholly objectionable.
I gotta admit, it was the kind of monkey that looks really scary to me.
Okay.
Because it kind of has a feline face, right?
Oh, okay. I know the type you're talking about. I gotcha. All right. Well, so, all right. Maybe, within reason and no monkeys. Got it.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to go with no lower primates in general.
Got it. Okay.
So no chimps, no gorillas. Humans,
really,
most of them.
You're thinking like a policy writer right there.
Yeah,
like, let's make sure that we get all the subclasses that I intend to.
All the possibilities.
No bononos. No.
Yeah.
Specifically mention all the different
lemurs?
Ones.
No lemurs.
Well, anyway, let's move on to this day in church history. Which will be October 15th. So this day in church history, our first entry comes from 1385. Sees Dionysus passing away in prison. The Orthodox Archbishop of Suzdal. I said that wrong. I said some of that wrong. The Orthodox Archbishop of Suzdal died in the prison of Dionysus. I was going to...
Oh, okay.
I was sitting there going like, Dionysus is a place, not a person. Got it. Yeah. So the archbishop had founded a monastery encouraging his people in their struggle against the Tartars and spoke out against heretical leaders, one of those who felt the sting of his preaching. I love what a great entry. The sting of his preaching, Vladimir Olgardovich. Wow, what a cool name. The Prince of Kiev arrested and imprisoned him, he never left.
I thought he was going to play right wing for Columbus, being a Russian.
Yes, hockey season is upon us. Our right winger, no, is not Russian, now that I think about it.
Wow.
He's a young American kid, well, on the first line.
I said corrected.
Shame on you. So that is our first entry, the passing of the Orthodox Archbishop of Suzdal.
That's putting it so diplomatically, since he was executed.
Well, it just says death in prison.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean.
Yeah, so it could have been tortured.
A long-term execution.
Yeah.
prolonged. 1573, the Lutheran scholar Stephen Gerlach delivers a letter on behalf of Lutheran leaders to ecumenical patriarch Jeremias II to feel out the possibility of a Lutheran Orthodox union. The overtures eventually fail because differences are sadly too great.
They really would be that era.
Yeah. Which more thanks but no thanks have occurred throughout human history than like, yeah, let's do that.
Well, okay, little trivia thing.
Mm-hmm.
When before the Episcopal Church started ordaining women, the Orthodox members in the United States who did not have an Orthodox church in their community were instructed by the bishops to go to an Episcopal church because our theology was closer to the Orthodox than the Roman Catholic churches were.
Okay. Interesting.
But then we started ordaining women. It was like,
that branch died.
Yeah. That connection died.
Yeah. Sorry. We have engaged in a few bridges too far for some folks. Yeah. And, you know what? Frankly, for the most part, I'm proud of those.
Yeah, no regrets.
Mm-mm.
And brought us closer to the Lutherans, actually.
Right, exactly. 1582, with the introduction of the Gregorian calendar in Italy, France, Spain, and Portugal, October 5th becomes October 15th.
Huh.
Yeah. So
leap week?
1582... the introduction of the Gregorian calendar caused the time travel of 10 days. Sorry, we're just getting a message here. We're getting a message. I believe it's for Father Bruce, so I'll let him read it. Not out loud, I don't think, as I looked at it. Some of the younger parishioners have sent us a letter. So yeah, 1582, the change over to the Gregorian calendar caused some time travel. I like it. 1647, the larger Westminster Catechism is completed. More words?
I think. What year was it?
1647.
I believe that was the Presbyterian. Catechism, and you know, Presbyterians and Episcopalians and all were spinning off from the Roman Catholic Church, so people were used to having a catechism. And so I'm pretty sure that's the Presbyterian one. The Episcopalians now call it, if you're checking your prayer books, an outline of the faith.
Cool.
It's in every Book of Common Prayer.
1846, Isaac Hecker makes his vows. He will form the Paulists, a group determined to win Americans to the Roman Catholic Church.
And they eventually became one of the most liberal religious orders in the world. And one of the things they're famous for was being very comfortable with technology. So they actually made some fantastic movies. That be like a half hour long exploring different ethical and theological issues that I remember, you know, this was in the 1970s. And
interesting.
I can remember seeing them in our Episcopal Church youth group meetings, and they were really well done.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Paulists. 1894. This is an interesting, story-like entry here. The individual's name, if I butcher it here, is Ronnie Sololambo, a diviner of Madagascar. He throws away all his amulets and apparatus of divination. The night before, wretched with ulcers, he had called out to the god of Norwegian missionaries and sensed he must get rid of his sorcerous props. Doing so on this day, he immediately feels a weight lift off of him. He knows that he has become a new man and begins reading the Bible. As he assimilates the message of the New Testament, he will begin soul winning. A group calling themselves Disciples of the Lord will form around him and become an evangelistic force on the island.
Which island?
Madagascar.
Oh, that's what you did. Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
Yeah.
I hear he also had an inexplicable longing for smoked herring. Having a Norwegian connection myself, that's one of the hallmarks.
For the three of you out there that got that joke.
That's right.
Congratulations on your Norwegian heritage. I thought that was kind of an interesting entry because it really was like years ago. Like it was kind of like designed that way. 1894, death in Calcutta of Jani Ali, a convert from Islam who had labored for many years as a Christian educator in Bombay and Calcutta. 1906, sees the death of Samuel Porter, or Sam Jones. American.
Wait, Samuel Porter or Sam Jones?
Samuel Porter, quote unquote, Sam Jones.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
So Sam, yeah, probably Sam Jones is probably how he would be known, considering where the Sam is put into his name. Mm-hmm. American Methodist evangelist. Once an alcoholic, he had fulfilled a promise to his dying father to quit drinking and found spiritual power to do so.
Nice.
Let's see here. Next entry comes from 1906. Death in Tokyo of Joseph Shurasuwensky. That is hard. Shurasuwensky, who, while studying as a rabbinic student in Germany, had converted to Christianity, eventually becoming an Episcopalian.
Yes.
He served as a missionary to China and was bishop of Shanghai, where he translated the Bible and other Christian works into the Wenli language, continuing work even after he had become almost totally paralyzed.
Yes. He typed out his translation with his feet.
Are you serious?
I'm serious.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. I remember my first year of seminary.
I'm not going to lie. I was waiting for that to be a joke coming from you.
I remember my first year of seminary, which had a daily services. And on his saints day, and the preacher talked about that. You could just, you could see, 60, 70 seminarians going, what? Okay. No punchline. Yeah, okay. You were like a seminarian.
There you go. Yeah, I imagine more than once that story has been told and people go, ha! No? Really?
Right, right.
I don't know why I laughed. The more I think about it, actually, that's terrible of me to think that it would be a joke. But yeah, it how cool. Did I come anywhere close to saying his name right?
No.
How do you say it?
I don't know.
Oh, so you judge me, but you give no constructive criticism.
I have to see it in front of me to say it.
You're dyslexic. What good is seeing it?
I know
there's like nine S's in here.
I know how through the, because I've had to celebrate the saint.
Shurashewski?
That's much closer.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I do long E's instead. Okay. Got it.
I just, I've had to say so many Eucharists with that name in it that I know in my dyslexia, when I see it, how to say it.
Interesting. Dyslexia is so cool.
But like,
actually,
if you spelled it out loud, I'd be, ugh.
I think dyslexia is so cool. I know there's a stigma around it, but I think the way that the brain then works as a result of it is so fascinating.
Well, it's so much more entertaining to read roadside signs. Because I read products that would never be advertised.
Very cool. Our last entry here comes from 1932. Gladys Aylward sails from Liverpool, bent on bringing the gospel to China, despite being told by missionary boards that she is not fit for the task. Her heroic adventures and rescue of over 100 orphans will inspire the film Inn of the Sixth Happiness.
Oh.
Which sounds familiar?
I think that's a Turner Classic Movies level of film.
Okay, it's a... Yeah. 1959.
Yeah.
Okay.
Who starred in it?
Ingrid Bergman.
Yeah. I've seen that.
Yeah.
On Turner Classic Movies.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Yeah, no, this is... I have seen this movie. Okay, sorry. Sorry for the listeners at home as I, stare at something that's not helpful to you. I have seen this. That's a... The captain also. Oh, Robert Dunn. Okay. Yeah.
It's a little sappy, but.
Well, I mean, it's 1950s movie. So yeah, there is a.
It's one of those don't be a communist.
It is of the. Yeah. It's of the era as well. So its version of sappiness is not modern day version of sappiness either. So it's. Mm-hmm. It's that's the Hollywood cheek to cheek era.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Twin beds.
Yep. You got it. But yeah, so, and that's it. That's this day in church history. A lot of terribly pronounced names on my part, and apologies to them.
All sorts of wider cultural references brought in.
Yeah. Really good.
Paulists would be proud of us.
There you go. So let's go to our first reading for the day, for the week. This first reading comes to us from Isaiah chapter 25, verses 1 through 9. O Lord, you are my God. I will exalt you. I will praise your name, for you have done wonderful things, plans formed of old, faithful and sure. For you have made the city a heap, the fortified city a ruin. The place of aliens is a city no more. It will never be rebuilt. Therefore, strong peoples will glorify you. Cities of ruthless nations will fear you. For you have been a refuge to the poor, a refuge to the needy in their distress, a shelter from the rainstorm and a shade from the heat. When the blast of the ruthless was like a winter rainstorm, the noise of aliens like heat in a dry place, you subdued the heat with the shade of clouds. The song of the ruthless was stilled. On this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wines, of rich food filled with marrow, of well-aged wines strained clear. And he will destroy on this mountain the shroud that is cast over all peoples, the sheet that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death forever. Then the Lord God will wipe away the tears from all faces and the disgrace of his people. He will take away from all the earth, for the Lord has spoken. It will be said on that day, lo, this is our God. We have waited for him so that he might save us. This is the Lord for whom we have waited. Let us be glad and rejoice in his salvation. This feels like second Isaiah. Is this second Isaiah? This is third?
Yep.
Already in 25?
Well, okay, now I gotta look it up. But it's...
I mean, far be it for me to question. It feels second to me.
It's a cusp. One.
Right there on the cusp somewhere. I was just... I suppose I was feeling second Isaiah.
It's second.
Okay.
Yeah.
Look at me.
Look at you. But it is a cusp. Because it's one of the first places where it says, okay, it's okay to go back now.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I suppose what I was going to say is the reason it felt second Isaiah to me was it still kind of has this, something in the tone of it was still a little bit of uncertainty about, like, it felt less certain about the return to me in some way. I can't pinpoint like where in here, but there was something about it that it was kind of like, boy, when this happens, you know what I mean? It's,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, there's a bit of future orientation.
Yeah. But it's got all sorts of language in here that I have questions about. First of all, the use of the word alien or aliens, which the first one occurs there in the second verse. Kind of curious if there's a little bit more robust word meaning here. Is it simply like foreign? You know, foreign people. The palace of aliens is a city no more. It's kind of an interesting description, and it feels weird to read, honestly.
Yeah, I'm reading the Hebrew now. Interesting. Alien is not used in the dictionary, which admittedly is a fairly old Hebrew dictionary, but it's instead a stranger, someone who's a foreigner, and usually an enemy.
Oh, okay.
And one of the meanings in Hebrew in the Bible, it could be a prostitute.
Interesting.
Or for those of you who like Turner Classic Movies, a harlot.
A harlot and a charlatan.
Yes.
What about earlier in that verse? The word heap is a strikes me as very British, and so I wonder. For you have made the city a heap.
A less fun one is ruin.
Okay. Yeah. Which is
though it this Hebrew word only occurs once.
Hmm.
So
here. Interesting.
Yeah.
So essentially, the translation looks at it and goes, okay, we don't know what this word is, but following traditional Hebrew poetry of kind of like repeating concepts kind of in succession, so that you kind of get like the same thing said from a slightly different angle. The next phrase is the fortified city, a ruin. So why don't we go with another, like a synonymous word for ruin?
So it can also mean by the way that word is constructed,
mm-hmm.
a heap of dead bodies.
That changes it a little bit.
Turns bit. Turns up the heat.
Yeah. It's interesting that the use of the word ruthless a lot here too. And I'm kind of curious. So I'm sorry. I'm doing a whole bunch of translative questions mm-hmm. here.
Fortunately, you're going in order. So
I'm trying to do it in order. In verse 3 is the first time where we see the word ruthless, but it's used like 3 times. But kind of in quick succession in these 3 successive verses.
Yeah, and it again, just the straight out Hebrew, ruthless, that's good, or terror striking, mm-hmm. terrifying, and even awe-inspiring.
Hmm.
But terrible or ruthless in the context seems like that's the way to go.
Yeah, the imagery in the next verse is very interesting to me which is one of the reasons why I was curious what ruthless was, because it just, when the blast of the ruthless is like, oh, like it's one thing to have ruthless pair it with the word nations, but it almost feels like the way that it's translated here is ruthless with a capital R. Like it's like,
yeah,
almost like we should know who the author is talking about.
Yes. And I believe it's the Moabs.
Oh.
Let's see. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, wait. Nope. That's a further verse on.
Interesting. Okay.
But it's the it's the Babylonians.
Okay, it is the Babylonians. Yeah. So it's their captors.
Yeah.
But yeah, what an interesting description. When the blast of the Babylonians, the ruthless, was like a winter rainstorm. And it's just like, just even reading that gives me chills. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, oh, so miserable. Like nothing worse than a right on the line of freezing rainstorm. Mm-hmm. Especially in a period where shelter is, you know, not 100% great. You know what I mean? Like, just terrible, terrible, terrible. Then the noise of aliens, and again that word again, mm-hmm. like heat in a dry place. You subdued the heat. With the shade of clouds, the song of the ruthless was stilled. There was all this imagery of like weather and temperature, which kind of goes back and forth in such a way that I'm trying to, like, my brain doesn't quite figure out how it's like what it's talking about or like what its point is until like reading it a couple of times.
Yeah.
So during a period of time when the Babylonians were like a winter rainstorm, the noise of aliens, kind of going back to that earlier reference of the palace of aliens,
right?
Being a city no more, really talking about you know, the Israelites, right? If I'm not mistaken, or is like,
no, well, most of this is about the Babylonians.
Okay. The Babylonians. Oh, I gotcha. Okay. So the noise of these people were like a, like heat in a dry place, which would counteract the winter rainstorm. Right.
Well, it's kind of the worst of all worlds.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's way too hot or way too cold and wet.
Gotcha. And then you subdued the heat with the shade of clouds. So that counteracts the heat.
Yeah.
So we're back to the winter rainstorm.
No, it's clouds. It's not rain.
Okay. All right. All right. And anyway,
it finally gets moderate.
Gotcha. And the song of the Babylonians was stilled.
Yeah.
So just like,
it was dead.
There you go. But like, yeah, just in that one phrase, like my brain does actually get the point, which was like, it's basically this tempestuous back and forth and
chaotic,
like
weather.
Yes, yeah. chaos, that finally resulted in, the stillness of the empire, the final collapse of it.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting way to describe like death throes of, such a group, an empire.
It's one of the reasons Isaiah is beloved. It's amazing literature.
Mm-hmm.
Or
poetic in nature, and one that, again, I have to like sit with, like, in order to, like, I'm reading it as I go along here, like 4 minutes ago, and I'm like, all right, I like the way these words have been put together. We're still working on what it means. But yeah. And then, it goes on this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food. And here's where we go back into the traditional, Hebrew poetry style, a feast of well-aged wines, of rich food filled with marrow, of well-aged wines strained clear. Rich foods filled with marrow, implying like, you know, you just think of like any, you know, bone in kind of steak or beef product or something, you know, just, you know, they're juicy. They're not like dried and burnt all the heck.
Right.
You know, it's
properly prepared.
Properly prepared, a lot of flavor. And then I'm not sure. Well-aged wines strained clear is an interesting phrase. You strain out all the tannins and it's
well, the tannins, the stems, the skins.
Gotcha. So it's really more talking about like the particulates are gone. Not that it's like red wine turned white clear.
Right.
Just more talking about like, hey, instead of like the garbage most of most of us get to drink, which does, like, oh, stem,
right.
Gross. It is fine wine.
There's nothing chewy in there.
Yeah, exactly. So there you go, all you wine aficionados. You have no idea how good you have it.
Yeah, in fact,
an era's worth of terrible winemaking. Or I shouldn't say terrible winemaking, but like,
let's just say it was heavy.
We have really, yeah. You could chew it.
Yeah. and part of the reason for that is that it would take it a lot longer to turn to vinegar by having all those chunks in it.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Cool. It would stay at the alcohol stage of fermentation longer.
Interesting. And he will destroy on this mountain the shroud that is cast over all peoples, the sheet that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death forever. I feel like that also is kind of talking about the Babylonian Empire. I feel like that is the shroud, the cast, the sheet.
Sort of.
Okay.
It's the shroud is a burial shroud.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same word. And Babylonia was an instrument of death.
Yeah.
And so it's more Babylonia's power to kill the Israelites is going to be set aside.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And maybe that's what you're saying, but.
Well, yeah, I suppose initially I was more thinking like the empire itself, but you're right. It definitely did represent, you know, if not death, hard times and imprisonment.
Yes.
So. Forced labor.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah.
So what? And this is one of the early places in Isaiah where, well, no, I'll take that back. It's an example, as Isaiah often does, of taking the particular experience of the Israelites and making it apply to all people.
Okay, yeah.
So in many Christian burial services, this last part of what we have today is one of the lessons read.
Oh, okay.
Of the victory over death.
Yeah. No. Oh, okay. I gotcha. Anything else about this Isaiah writing?
No. Well, the in verse 8,
mm-hmm.
God will swallow up death forever. Then the Lord God will wipe away the tears from all faces, and the disgrace of his people he will take away from the earth, for the Lord has spoken. It's this interesting juxtaposition or combination of death and disgrace
mm-hmm.
being the same thing.
Okay.
And it's something that, as Christians, it's sometimes hard for us to connect with, because we think of death as, oh, get to go to heaven.
Right.
Whereas here it was, oh, death, you're destroyed. And everything you worked for is gone.
Right.
Isaiah did have a sense of an afterlife, but this passage is more connected with what's happening for the people left behind.
Mm-hmm.
And that the grief, God will wipe away the tears, and the sense of he died too young or whatever the grief is filling the grief. That'll be set aside by God. That'll be healed by God.
That makes sense too, because a lot of the concepts in the Old Testament are really geared around one of the reasons why the genealogies are mm-hmm. so important, but like geared around that how your line carries on, which yeah. is why things like the entry of the reference of sins being passed down to the generation to generation was so powerful for that and seems so ridiculous to us, but like
Isaiah did say it was ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah, but it is baked into that yeah. you go, oh well if. You know, yeah, if God curses you and it goes, yeah. you know, four generations deep, that's just as you might as well just be dead. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like that's.
Thanks, Mom.
Right. Yeah. It just like that's you can't overcome that. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah, that's one of the reasons why we cared so much about or at least entries in the Bible cared so much about like this person begat this person who like.
Well, not so much.
No?
No, that more has to do with God's blessing continuing through the generations.
Okay, okay. Well, yeah, but still the same concept of like
well,
non-favor.
What I'm saying is that humans put the non-favored onto it. And you know, I can almost picture God saying, look, I gave you this great example of how generation after generation I've cared for you, even when you've ignored me. And you turn it so that you get to cast out people you don't like.
Right.
You said their dad was a swindler.
Okay. Yeah. No, I see your point. I see your point. Anything else?
That should do it for now.
Well, let's move on to a very little known psalm. Psalm 23. Stop me if you've heard it before.
Did we do this relatively recently?
I feel like we did.
Okay. We'll see if we repeat ourselves.
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in right paths for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I fear no evil. For you are with me, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil, my cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord my whole life long. Plenty of people have heard this. Plenty of people will have had a couple of moments in my reading of that where their head turns sideways because they're used to a slightly different interpretation
uh-huh.
That you grew up with. Obviously, this is one of the ones that – you know, if you've been in the church since you were a kid, you know, you were taught to be able to memorize one of the memorization pieces
of the King James Version.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So there,
it's on countless plaques and posters and bracelets. And
I always thought it was weird. this first verse, it always had really funny phrasing to me. In that, like, it sounds like it's saying something that it's not intending to say. The Lord is my shepherd. I don't want him. I always thought that was fun. Like, I shall not want. And I'm like, the Lord is my shepherd. No, thank you.
I am shocked. I never thought of that.
Because it really should say something like, I shall not be in want, or I shall not have want. Or...
But you added a him. To the very end.
Yeah.
I shall not want him.
I am good. Thank you so much. I am not
especially
a sheep.
Especially if we move along and see where I end up.
Right? I'm not a sheep. Thank you, but no thank you. But yeah, I always thought that was interesting, like weird wording. And now you're never going to be able to read it the same.
I will not, and I thank you.
And actually in a way it kind of continues into the second verse, and you know, here's the reasons why I don't want him. He makes me lie down. I can't lie where I want. Forces me to lie. I mean, granted, that's nice. Green pastures. Thanks. That's where I want to be, but don't make me.
You're not the boss of me.
I mean, you are, but I mean, come on. Give me the illusion of choice. Obviously that's not what it's saying.
But I seriously appreciate you being so human about it. Rather than pietistic. Yeah, I think I said that right.
Pietistic, yeah. Sure, why not? You're smarter than me. Just say a word and I'll nod. I think that we've talked about this before, the darkest valley reference in verse 4. In other interpretations, it's the valley of the shadow of death.
Mm-hmm.
And so that really is, in a way, that interpretation does get a little bit closer to the point where I feel like this translation does kind of miss it. Because the darkest valley is really like treacherous and full of death, is it not? Is that not kind of the imagery that it's trying to provoke?
But the problem with translating it as the valley of the shadow of death is it puts it, in my mind anyway, it puts it to the extreme.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't had a lot of times walking somewhere thinking, I'm going to die here.
Mm.
I have had moments of walking somewhere and going, I shouldn't be here.
This might not be good.
I think I made an error of judgment.
Yeah. Yep.
Where is everyone? It just depends how the poetry of it hits you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I going back to the human interpretation, I believe I know the answer to this, but I'm going to do it again anyways. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. My first thought is like, am I really thanking him for beating me with his rod? But the imagery is of a shepherd. The rod is really more for protection against predators, right?
Yes.
The rod and staff are
it's not for the sheep.
Right. Yeah. It's not like a riding crop where you beat the horse you're on to tell them, you know, to keep them running straight or to tell them to watch the right or, you know, whatever it is. I'm not a horse rider, so I don't really know. I just assume that it has good meaning as to why there's a riding crop. But like those tools, those utensils are not meant to beat the sheep into like submission or to drive them in a certain direction.
Though there are conservative Christians, I haven't heard of a conservative rabbi pushing this, that do interpret it as, yeah, we get to beat the bejesus out of you,
right,
to make you behave.
That's true. I have come to think of it. Yeah. I am an instrument of God and the yep. rod and the staff. And yep. like, I'm here to beat some sense into you, kid. Yeah. Yeah. That's so take comfort.
Yeah.
And
just to be clear, I've never heard an Episcopal scholar, priest, parent use that interpretation.
Okay. Yeah.
It's in other corners of Christianity that comes out.
And then I feel like, we'll say these words and not really think about their meaning, but verse 5 in particular is a kind of really cool imagery, that if you take a moment, to think about what it's saying, is pretty neat. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil and my cup overflows. So, the imagery is I'm seated at a table. Those who are against me are opposite me at that table. And the imagery of anointing my head with oil is God publicly displaying favor.
Yes,
And elevating me to a higher position.
Yes.
And in front of those who are against me.
Yes.
And my cup overflowing, implying bounty and
huge abundance,
sustenance, all the things that I need to survive. Which is kind of like I think we can all connect with, like, boy, God, I really like that. I would love it if this would happen right in front of Becky. And I could shove her a little nose. You know what I mean? Like,
have some overflowing, right? Becky.
You like that? You like all this oil? Don't you wish it were you? But no, I mean, like, seriously though, that's the very human side of us. But like, we all would love to be have that feeling of, this is that feeling of being chosen. Yes. and being rewarded. Maybe not to the point where maybe we shouldn't want the goods that this implies, like the money, the power, the
what's money?
I'm just saying the cup over. Look, this is another one of those where wealth gospels. Extreme. You know what I mean? Like people use it that way. It's not so much that. It's like it should be, for at least me. It should be interpreted as like, you know, being acknowledged, like what the attitude that I have taken, the way that I've treated others, that gets promoted and like and shown to other people, like, hey, yeah, if you would just treat people the way this person has, they're doing great. That, like, play nice, be good, love God's creation, like that kind of a thing. And finally having those attitudes that plenty of other people in this world, you know, shake off. I'm like, yeah, you know, I don't know why you go do that stuff for other people. Take care of yourself. It's all about you. It's all about me mentality. And finally being able to show people, like, no, it's about us. Like, that should be rewarded.
True. Yeah.
Anything else about the psalm?
Two things. Just to disappoint you a bit.
Okay.
Becky's not going to be across the table. Becky's going to be at a distance.
Ah, okay.
The Hebrew word is being able to, the others can see you, but from a distance.
Okay.
Which
I would invite Becky a little closer. Come on. Come take a look. Oh my goodness, this cup, it keeps overflowing. I can hardly keep up.
Well, and that's, I think that's part of it, is that the feast is out of reach.
I gotcha. Okay.
The others.
Okay.
One other thing in verse 3, the word for soul, well, that's often translated as soul.
Mm-hmm.
The, as we've talked about before, Hebrew does not have a word for soul.
Right.
So it's life.
Okay.
He restores my life. And then in 6, the goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. That's replacing the pursuit by bad people.
Okay.
Instead, goodness and mercy shall pursue me, us, rather than the people who were coming out of the holes and
gotcha.
The
dark place. My enemies are left behind after the table.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, let's move on to our gospel reading.
Yes.
Another parable.
Cool.
Matthew chapter 22, verses 1 through 14. Once more, Jesus spoke to them in parables, saying, "The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who gave a wedding banquet for his son. He sent his slaves to call those who had been invited to the wedding banquet, but they would not come. Again, he sent other slaves, saying, 'Tell those who have been invited, look, I have prepared my dinner, my oxen and my fat calves have been slaughtered, and everything is ready. Come to the wedding banquet.' But they made light of it and went away, one to his farm, another to his business, while the rest seized his slaves, mistreated them, and killed them. The king was enraged. He sent his troops, destroyed those murderers, and burned their city. Then he said to his slaves, 'The wedding is ready, but those invited were not worthy. Go, therefore, into the main streets and invite everyone you find to the wedding banquet.' Those slaves went out into the streets and gathered all whom they found, both good and bad. So the wedding hall was filled with guests. But when the king came in to see the guests, he noticed a man there who was not wearing a wedding robe. And he said to him, 'Friend, how did you get in here without a wedding robe?' And he was speechless. Then the king said to the attendants, 'Bind him hand and foot and throw him into the outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. For many are called, but few are chosen.'" This one ends in a way that I feel is uncomfortable. It is for me, at least. The very similar feeling to start as to last week's parable, where slaves were, sent out by an authority figure, and those who received the slaves did an unthinkably dumb thing. Sending out, they made light of it and went away, one to his farm, another to his business, while the rest seized his slaves, mistreated them, and killed them. So, the wedding invitees received the message. One goes back to his farm, right? I'm interpreting this correctly. Another to work. His business.
Yeah.
And the rest captured the slaves, mistreated them, and killed them.
Right.
Brutally tortured and murdered them.
I don't want to go out tonight.
Unnecessary reaction to the, we've all received wedding invitations where we're like, I'm not doing that. Never before did we like...
I'm gonna go kill the postal carrier.
So postal carrier. I don't want to go. Stab, stab, stab.
Yeah.
Like just what? Why? Why would you do this?
Why are you being a little stabby?
Why would this be your reaction? What a dumb reaction, especially for a king.
Yeah.
Like unlike the prior parable that we covered. He does what we assumed he would do. Yeah. He goes out and kills, his troops kill them. I don't know what you thought was going to happen, but, burned their city to the ground, which is unfortunate because, of course,
not everyone
in that city murdered those slaves. Right. Anyways,
it's problematic.
Right, it's quite problematic. The banquet's ready. He sends his slaves out into the streets of his own kingdom and just pulls in everybody, right?
Yeah.
I wonder what those slaves thought, having heard the prior stories. I imagine, actually, they were probably were like, well, I feel pretty confident that I'm going to be okay. That word got around quick, and I don't think anybody's going to mistreat me with this message at this point, because I'm just going to be like, hey, the king's having a wedding. Do you want to die? No? Get your butt up there. then we have this weird interaction that seems
weirder
to
weirder.
Me to be quite inexplicable, which of course is oftentimes the case in a parable. You really have to imagine that, not to imply that they're dregs of society, but when it's like pull people from the streets, both good and bad, mm-hmm. there's a little bit of an implication of like, you know, hey, you know, the everybody from, you know, the bread baker down the street, a nice guy, to, you know, the poor person begging for change in the streets, and even the less desirable in the
pimps and
exactly
the swindlers,
everybody comes in. The king singles out, it implies there's one man who's not wearing a wedding robe, but I would imagine should a king go down this route of inviting everybody, there's plenty of poor people who don't have a wedding robe.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So for whatever reason, we're either encouraged to believe there's only one person who doesn't have a wedding robe, which doesn't make sense, or there were plenty of people who didn't have a wedding robe, and this king singles out one of them, which doesn't seem fair either. Friend, how did you get in here without a wedding robe? Bind him hand and foot, throw him into the outer darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth, which is very Monty Python-esque.
Yes.
That's the end. And then like the tagline for this parable: for many are called, but few are chosen. I'm sorry, Jesus. What am I supposed to take away from this? So Bruce, help me out here. What is my Lord and Savior trying to convey to me right now?
Well, first I got to point out one thing.
Sure, please.
That many are called, few are chosen. The next verse is, then the Pharisees went and plotted to entrap Jesus.
Okay. So they didn't like this parable either.
Yeah. He's really getting off the wall here. We're going to see if we can set ourselves up. Anyway. Well, I'm sure we'll hear more about that next week.
There you go.
So, yes, this is a very weird parable. It occurs in Luke without the weird parts.
Oh, is it more?
It's more straightforward to just people not showing up, and it's not a king, it's a householder.
Gotcha.
Who
and then invites everybody from the streets and has a wedding.
Yes.
And the end.
And the people who come and enjoy a good banquet.
Okay.
And the people who didn't miss out on the best banquet ever.
Mm.
So it's more of an analogy.
Yeah. Yeah. Way less of a parable in Luke. Okay.
So Matthew's trying to deal with this parable with a number of things. And one of them is the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans.
Okay.
So that's the city got burned because Matthew's interpreting that as God's punishment on Jerusalem for rejecting Jesus.
Okay.
And some of this is just nuts.
I can kind of see that, though. Okay, so Jesus is the slave in it for Matthew in this parable.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he's adding his own little twist on this.
Yeah. And
which makes you wonder if, like, are there portions of this story that are added by Matthew?
Oh yeah.
So
yeah, it's in biblical interpretation, the basic rule is shorter is older.
Okay.
And let's see, Luke is about 7 verses shorter.
Okay.
So it leaves out the city being destroyed, leaves out the tossing out of the poorly dressed guest.
Interesting. So it implies Matthew has added a little bit more of this to try to make sense of what Jesus was talking about?
Yeah. Didn't work,
poor,
did it?
Poor job, Matthew. Kind of a poor job here. You yeah. made it worse. you made this really hard.
Well, and part of that is, and that's one of the clues as to what a difficult time Matthew was living through.
Mm-hmm.
That could not make sense of what was going on in the world around him. That the beloved city of God, Jerusalem, was destroyed. Why did that happen? Oh, it must be this.
Mm.
That all sorts of folks we thought would be favored by God are not being favored by God. Must be that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
in a way, it kind of, again, trying to do more of an analogy on it, especially if we think, Matthew might have played around with the story a little bit. It's almost like the author is trying to add in this weird part about the king getting mad.
Oh, is added.
The second time to try to explain maybe why more bad things happen.
Yeah.
Like the first one is cause and effect, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, I invited you to a nice party and you murdered some people, so I'm going to raise your city to the ground. Like, I'll escalate. If you want to escalate, let's go, bro. you know what I mean? Like, it's like cause and effect makes sense. This last one, while it's definitely like raising the level in as far as response to the point of like kind of equivalent of raising the city to the ground, not really that warranted.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's kind of as if, in my mind, it's as if Matthew's trying to explain like, yeah, sometimes, Jerusalem gets burned to the ground because of something that we've done. And then other times, you can kind of forgive God for also zapping you with lightning because, his slave, he's trying to invite people to a nice party and he's still got a little bit of excess anger over that. You know what I mean? Like, it's almost like
God didn't do therapy yet.
Right. Exactly. It's almost like we're trying to explain why some bad things happen and there's no good explanation. As far as like, the king's still distraught. It's like, it's a wedding party and the people didn't come. And if he singled out one guy and threw him out into the streets bound, everybody else at least got a good party. So it's not, it could be worse.
I've always pictured the guy being thrown out the back door.
There you go.
Into the street.
There you go. Hello?
Yeah. I'm still here.
I could run home and get my wedding robe if you'd let me.
Just unbind my...
If you could just untie me real quick, that'd be great. Oh, those are wolves. Oh, no.
They're matching. They're matching.
Right? But yeah, it almost feels like that it's that kind of additive of like, this definitely happened for a reason. Also, some weird things happen in I don't know, maybe this story will help explain it.
A lot of shrugging shoulders going on.
Huh? Thoughts? But it really does. It does not, it's one of those turns in as far as parables go. For me, this one, you're like, I don't know as if I like doesn't this one doesn't feel good. This one does not feel good for me.
And part of one commentator, not more than one, tries to whitewash it by saying both sets of bad things here reflect on people not living out the gospel.
Okay.
Followers of Christ not living out the gospel, and that still upsets God.
Mm.
And that's the cause and effect. What's better to do, though, is to try to stay in the spirit of parable and see where it does seem crazy and not make God the king.
Right.
and not make, and so therefore it's not God who destroyed Jerusalem. It's not God who beat the crap out of the person without the wedding robe. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's poopy humans.
Yeah. Which, especially in the con, I went down this whole road already having, you know, the alternate thought anyways, because it was fun to play.
Yeah.
But especially as you pointed out, the Pharisees then went and plotted to kill him.
Yeah.
They clearly thought he was talking about them. And if you think about that, like, oh yeah, we always want to make God the king. That makes sense for storytelling purposes.
Mm-hmm.
This to me seems as though the parable is pointing out, like, this is a mirror.
Yeah.
This is what you do. This is what you do. And your thought of, like, why would the king be such a cruddy person to, like, you know, it's a wedding. It, like, you show this generosity of bringing people, like, the people you did invite weren't worthy, and you showed the generosity of inviting other people. And not sitting there going like, well, you're too low class to participate in this. You know, you opened your doors and then freaked out over something dumb. You know what I mean? And not only did you like, no, you can't join us. You know, you're not wearing a wedding robe. You're disinvited. You like imply essentially binding this person and tossing them out where they're going to die.
Yeah. A slow and terrible death.
Yeah. Why would you do that? And that's, to me, is what the parable is saying to me, the reader, is why do you behave like this?
Yeah. And why do you think I, as God, behave like
right.
this? Right. It's because you do. Or at least you're tempted to.
Right. Right, right. And this line of, for many are called, but few are chosen, really leads us, I think, in a way, misdirects us into thinking that's the point of my parable, is so find the meaning somewhere in here. And it's really talking about how, you know, how do you react when the call comes, and how do you react when you're in the position of sharing or interacting with other people.
How do you react when you're in the position of power
over
other people?
Right. And so in this example, many are called, few are chosen. You're sitting there thinking about the invitees. But what if we apply that phrase to the king?
Yeah. Yeah.
Does he get chosen as a result? Probably not.
Right.
Probably not. I think if anybody there witnessed that and saw this behavior, this guy like kills people for doing, you know, looking at him wrong, essentially. Chance I get for a new king.
That's right.
You better believe it, buddy. This wedding feast is fine and all for right now, and I'll smile and nod through it. But, you know, if somebody new comes along, you better believe we're backing a new horse.
Or you better have a wine taster in
right, exactly, because it wasn't you that was thrown out into the darkness this time.
Yeah,
this time. So anyway, that's that is my interpretation, at least. Of
I think you've done very well.
That's all I really wanted, and so we'll just close.
Yeah.
Actually, we have run a little long, so we will
end with a win.
Hey, you know what? I don't get them that often. So with that, we'll call to a close this year podcast for October 15th, 2023, the 20th Sunday after Pentecost. We're really coming up on it.
Stretch.
Yeah. Just another month and a half or so. As always, we encourage you to join us in worship, however it works for you, for your household, for this week. 8 and 10 o'clock in person on Sundays, 9 o'clock educational hour for all ages, lots of options for the adults as well. The 10 o'clock service will be broadcast on our YouTube channel, HFEC Videos. And until next week, I'm Ben.
I'm Bruce.
And we'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.